that's ever. Hello, everyone. We want to get started on time-ish, which means now. Because I'm not good at paring this down to an hour. I'm terrible at it. Consistently bad at it. And Chris knows this as well as anyone. Because we have also done presentations together on Israel-Palestine, and it's such a struggle for me.
He's not wrong. Yep.
That is a fact. My name is Josh Viss. I'm the host and program director, co-founder of Still Processing. And Still Processing is this, what we're doing tonight. It's getting together and talking about serious things like meaning and purpose and politics and human thriving and emotions and the problem that men are having, the problems that feminism is having, right? All of these kinds of things. And we started this in November of 2022. And we have been doing every month since then. And it's been great. But we're still working on a really concise definition of what we are, as you can tell. Tonight I'm joined by Chris DeBlay, my good friend, also my work partner. We work together on Israel-Palestine for the Reformed Church in America. We're still welcome there for now. And we're going to keep trying if they'll have us. It is getting tricky, admittedly.
It sure is, yeah.
We're getting asked things like, are you an atheist? Tough question. Depends on the day is what I usually say. Chris is my good friend. We met in 2017, and he's become one of my best friends in the world. That is a fact.
Same. Yep.
And he's a blessing to me because he will listen to me rant. And he will listen to things I send him and tell me what he thinks of them. And I don't have a ton of people who are willing to do that. Because my mind is annoying in certain ways because it doesn't stop moving. But he's willing to do that, as is his wife, Bethany, who's also been a guest here multiple times. She's a trauma therapist. She did work with us on trauma, on emotions. So we're family friends, work partners. And I'm grateful that you were able to fill in as we moved Cynthia from this month to next month, because she got an opportunity to short film in Kalamazoo. Big opportunity. We didn't want to hold her up on that. We knew we could find a way to make this work. And then, of course, current events made it very easy in certain ways to craft something together. So, Chris, thanks for being here.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Okay. This is Ezra Klein. I've used his stuff a lot. But let me just say, he's a New York Times opinion writer and podcaster. And I think he's really emerging as one of the clearest voices in journalism. Just one of the clearest voices in journalism. And he's going to sum up for us where he thinks we're at. And we agree that this is where we're at as a country.
The emergency is here. The crisis is now. It's not 6 months away. It's not another Supreme Court ruling from happening. It is happening now. Maybe not to you, not yet, but to others, to real people whose names we know, whose stories we know. The President of the United States is disappearing people to an El Salvadoran prison for terrorists, a prison known by its initials, CECOT, a prison built for disappearance. A prison where there is no education or remediation or recreation, because it is a prison that does not intend to release its inhabitants back out into the world. It is a prison where the only way out, in the words of El Salvador's justice minister, is in a coffin. On Monday, President Trump said in the Oval Office, in front of the eye of the cameras, sitting next to El Salvador's president, that he would like to do this to U.S. citizens as well. If President Donald Trump decides that you are to rot in a foreign prison, then that is his right. And you have no rights. We are not even 100 days into this administration, and we are already faced with this level of horror. And I can feel the desire to look away from it, even in me. What all this demands is too inconvenient, too disruptive. But Trump has said it all plainly and publicly. He intends to send those he hates to foreign prisons beyond the reach of U.S. law. He does not care. He will not even seek to discover if those he is sending into these foreign hells are guilty of what he claims, because this is not about their guilt. It is about his power. And if he is capable of that, if he wants that, then what else is he capable of? What else does he want? And if the people who serve him are willing to give him that, to defend his right to do that, what else will they give him? What else will they defend? This is the emergency. Like it or not, it's here.
I think it speaks for itself, honestly. And as we go, we're going to kind of fill in some of the details about the emergency, about the people whose lives have been maybe forever altered. So I don't have much more, anything.
Yeah, I just want to say the line that sticks out to me is, I can feel the desire to look away. And as we'll talk about later tonight, the road ahead is going to require a great deal of courage. It's very courageous to not look away, to be honest about what's happening, to keep talking, to keep reading, to keep showing up. And I even think that your presence here tonight is an act of courage. You could have chosen to stay home, do any number of things. You've chosen to come and to engage. That's a courageous act. We're going to need to keep being courageous.
Excellent. So I'm going to show throughout this a couple of recurring faces and videos. One of them is Valerie Kaur, who I've used before, so you may remember the name. She's a renowned civil rights leader, lawyer, award-winning filmmaker, educator, innovator, and best-selling author of See No Stranger. She is the founder of the Revolutionary Love Project, where she leads a movement to reclaim love as a force for justice. And I'm going to play the first part of what she calls a revolutionary love compass. And I want to say before I do that her material mixed in with the other material we have is going, I think, for some of you, at least this is how it is for me, seem naive. I think it's going to seem like it's not enough. Like it's too loving. It's not strong enough for what we're facing. And I just want to say that at the beginning, in case that's how you feel about it. But I think she has tremendous stuff to offer, and I'll try and explain why as we go. But this is her first part of her video on what she calls a revolutionary love compass, and she'll explain it.
Welcome to the Revolutionary Love Compass. Imagine that you are holding this compass in your hand, and you can point it to who you wish to practice loving. Revolutionary love is the choice to labor for others, opponents, and ourselves. That's that outer ring. And so you can point it to an other. That practice is called See No Stranger. You see that inner ring? It begins with wonder. Can you wonder about the person in front of you? You can say in your mind, you are a part of me I do not yet know. When you do that, you open yourself to that person's story. And that leads to that next practice, to grieve. To grieve with others, to weep with others, to share in their sorrows. That gives you information for how to fight for others. Wondering about others, grieving with others, fighting for others. These are the elements for what I call deep solidarity. Shallow solidarity is rooted in the logic of exchange. I show up for you, so you show up for me. But deep solidarity is rooted in love. Wondering about others, grieving with others, fighting for others, those are elements for how to practice seeing no stranger.
So this next video is a hard video to watch, but I think it's important for us to watch it together. And I think setting it up as seeing no stranger in the faces you're about to see is apt and important. It's also, for me, been a the grieving part of this has been very real to me. I don't know how to distinguish it from sadness and anger, even rage, I would say, at times. But I think maybe grief is the term that encompasses all of those very complicated feelings, and they've been very real to me. So Philip Holsinger is someone you're going to see in here. He's an American photojournalist, and he happened to be along for the deportation of what ended up being 238 people to an El Salvadoran prison. And this is his explanation of what he saw, along with the pictures of what he saw.
When the planes carrying the Venezuelan migrants arrived in El Salvador, Holsinger was waiting on the tarmac. He photographed the men as they were shackled, shaved, and stripped, capturing their transformation into Sukkot inmates. Holsinger wrote about the experience in an article for Time magazine. Some of those photos have been published or televised elsewhere, but most of what he shared with 60 Minutes has never been seen before.
As soon as they came to the door, they're greeted by a sea of black-clad, masked police and riot gear. This is a typical face of the Venezuelans. These are eyes that are asking lots of questions. Where am I? What's happening? You know, what's going to happen to me? A lot of fear in these faces. Their appearance was different than anything I had seen. Literally, like they'd just come off the street. They were all in nice clothes. They move them fast and hard, and they intentionally want them to feel that they're powerless. They grab them in the neck, march them down the stairs, and it's rapid and fast and painful. These guys were not allowed to be making eye contact or looking, and a guard came and grabbed his head and forced his head down to tell him, you're not allowed to be looking up and looking around. And then they go right into a room where they shave everybody's head. And they don't shave their heads, you know, tenderly. The guards are just, you know, fast, 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 rapido, 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 rapido. So some of them are nicking their heads. This man really grabbed my attention. He may be a criminal. He may be innocent. He may be a father. I don't know his story at all, but I know his eyes. He didn't fight. Hopelessness just gave in.
One of the Venezuelans who caught Holsinger's attention was this man, who 60 Minutes has now identified as Andriy Hernandez Romero. Andriy's lawyer told us he is a 31-year-old gay man and makeup artist with no criminal record in the United States or Venezuela.
So this is a young man that I had followed from the bus who was exclaiming that he was soy gay and saying that he was innocent. And he was, you know, being slapped every time he would speak up, but he just, like, he couldn't help himself. Then he started praying and calling out, literally crying for his mother. His crying out for his mother really, you know, touched me.
So the vast majority, as far as I can tell, of the names of the people that we sent to a foreign prison are still unknown, as far as I know. And I've been paying attention. So we know about this gentleman. We've learned his name, Andre. We, 60 Minutes, as a part of this, also did an investigation. I haven't seen all the release of names, but they were able to get names. And they found that 75% had no criminal record in the U.S. or outside the U.S. So 3/4 of the people who were sent there, as far as we know, have no criminal record whatsoever. So then, and this is the last, like, really hard video to watch, and this one is not as hard as the last one, but I think it's important to watch this one as well. So Bukele, who is the, I don't know if he's the president or prime minister, but president of El Salvador, came to the United States, sat in the Oval Office with Donald Trump, and as you'll see, J.D. Vance was there. Marco Rubio was there. Marco Rubio is Secretary of State. J.D. Vance, Vice President. Pam Bondi, Attorney General. And also you're going to hear Stephen Miller. It's the hardest one to listen to by far for me as well. I agree with your yuck assessment 100%. They then put on this theatrical display about these people. And I think we should watch it.
Let's hear the question from this very low-rated anchor at CBS.
Thank you, President. Do you plan to ask President Bukele to help return the man who your administration says was mistakenly deported? The man who was mistakenly deported to El Salvador?
Well, let me ask Pam, would you answer that question?
Sure, President. First and foremost, he was illegally in our country. He had been illegally in our country. And in 2019, two courts, an immigration court and an appellate immigration court, ruled that he was a member of MS-13 and he was illegally in our country. Right now, additional paperwork had needed to be done. That's up to El Salvador if they want to return him. That's not up to us. The Supreme Court ruled, President, that if, as El Salvador wants to return him, this is international matters, foreign affairs, if they wanted to return him, we would facilitate it, meaning provide a plane.
So will you return him?
And you are doing a great job.
Thank you.
Yes. Stephen Miller, wait a minute. Can you just also respond to that question? Because, you know, it's asked by CNN, and they always ask it with a slant, because they're totally slanted because they don't know what's happening. That's why nobody's watching them. But would you answer that question also, please?
Yes, gladly. So as Pam mentioned, there's an illegal alien from El Salvador. So with respect to you, he's a citizen of El Salvador. So it's very arrogant even for American media to suggest that we would even tell El Salvador how to handle their own citizens as a starting point. As two immigration courts found that he was a member of MS-13. When President Trump declared MS-13 to be a foreign terrorist organization, that meant that he was no longer eligible under federal law, which I'm sure you know, you're very familiar with the INA, that he was no longer eligible for any form of immigration relief in the United States. So he had a deportation order that was valid, which meant that under our law, he's not even allowed to be present in the United States and had to be returned because of the foreign terrorist designation. This issue was then, by a district court judge, completely inverted, and a district court judge tried to tell the administration that they had to kidnap a citizen of El Salvador and fly him back here. That issue was raised to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said the district court order was unlawful, and its main components were reversed 9-0 unanimously, stating clearly that neither Secretary of State nor the President could be compelled by anybody to forcibly retrieve a citizen of El Salvador from El Salvador, who again is a member of MS-13, which, as I'm sure you understand, rapes little girls, murders women, murders children, is engaged in the most barbaric activities in the world, and I can promise you, if he was your neighbor, you would move right away.
Can President Bukele weigh in on this? Do you plan to return him?
Well, I'm supposed to have suggested that I smuggle a terrorist into the United States, right? How can I return him to the United States? Like, I smuggle him into the United States, or what do I do? Of course, I'm not going to do it. It's like, the question is preposterous. How can I smuggle a terrorist into the United States? I don't have the power to return him to the United States.
Marco, do you have something to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, Stephen Eitland, I don't understand what the confusion is. This individual is a citizen of El Salvador. He was illegally in the United States and was returned to his country. That's where you deport people, back to their country of origin, except for Venezuela that wasn't refusing to take people back or places like that. I can tell you this, Mr. President. No, the foreign policy of the United States is conducted by the President of the United States, not by a court. And no court in the United States has a right to conduct the foreign policy of the United States. It's that simple. End of story.
That is a complete cascade of lies and total bullshit. From start to finish. I don't know if there's a single word told in any of that by any person that is said in good faith. I'm sure none of it is said in good faith. The idea that I heard somebody on a podcast say, if we told the president of El Salvador to ride on a unicycle, and actually he said the associate deputy to Latin America were to tell the president of El Salvador to ride on a unicycle with the American flag wrapped around him, his question would be, which flag? That's the fact. This idea that he can't, it's absurd. I can't. We're going to get to the bottom of the truth about this person. I found this. He doesn't even know this is in here. And he's like, you complete moron. Why is there more stuff in here? And he's right. He's right. But I happened to look up like 2 hours ago, how popular is Nayib Bukele? I didn't like the answer at all. He is very popular. Has an 80% approval rating. If you look at this little piece here, right, in bold, it's little wonder that politicians across Latin America promise voters that they'll copy El Modelo Bukele, the Bukele model. I'm going to just say one last thing about this, because I'm not sure if we'll get to any of the stuff from Ann Applebaum that I have in here. But she wrote a book called Autocracy, Inc., meaning Autocracy Incorporated. And the point she makes is that there is now a network of autocracies that work together. These are not individuals trying to survive on their own in their own countries. And we are now seeing our president enter into that network. Bukele is a part of that network. Putin is obviously a part of that network. And the reason I include this is to say that I'm sorry to say that we cannot guarantee that this won't be popular. I'm going to skip over that. Check this out from Adam Serwer. Wrote this in 2016. The cruelty is the point. Don't have time for that whole thing, though. Okay, this is a little bit longer as well, but this is the truth about the person they were talking about. Did they ever say his name? No. They never even bothered to say his name. His name is Kilmar Abrego Garcia. And there are probably dozens of Kilmar Abrego Garcias now in that prison in El Salvador. This is again from Ezra Klein explaining what we actually know about Kilmar.
The Trump administration holds a view that anyone they send to El Salvador is beyond the reach of American law. They've been disappeared not just from our country, but from our system. And from any protection or process that our system affords, in our prisons, prisoners can be reached by our lawyers, by our courts, by our mercy. In El Salvador, they cannot. Names, stories. Let me tell you one of their names, one of their stories, as best we know it. Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia is from El Salvador. His mother, Cecilia, ran a pupuseria in San Salvador. A local gang, Barrio 18, began extorting the business, demanding monthly and then weekly payments. If the family didn't pay, Barrio 18 threatened to murder Kilmar's brother, Cesar, or rape their sisters. Eventually, Barrio 18 demanded Cesar join their gang, at which point the family sent Cesar to America. Then Barrio 18 demanded the same of Kilmar. And Kilmar, at age 16, was sent to America too. This was around 2011. This is what we mean when we say he entered illegally. A 16-year-old fleeing the only home he's ever known, afraid for his life. Abrego Garcia's life here just seems to have been a life, not an easy one. He lived in Maryland. He worked in construction. He met a woman. Her name is Jennifer, a U.S. citizen. She had two children from a past relationship. One has epilepsy, the other autism. In 2019, they had a child together. That child, who's now 5, is deaf in 1 year and also has autism. Jennifer was pregnant in 2019. On the day Abrego Garcia dropped one kid off at school, dropped the other off with a babysitter, and drove to Home Depot to try to find construction work. He was arrested for loitering outside Home Depot, asked if he was a gang member. He said no. And he's put into ICE detention. The story gets stranger from here. About 4 hours after he's picked up, and that appears to be the first contact he's ever had with local police, a detective produces an allegation, citing a confidential informant, that Abrego Garcia is actually a gang member. Abrego Garcia has no criminal record, not one here, not one in El Salvador. He was accused, strangely, of being part of a gang that operates in New York, a state that he has never lived in. Whoever produced the allegation, they were never cross-examined. And when Abrego Garcia's attorney tried to get more information, he was told that the detective behind the accusation had been suspended, and the officers in the gang unit would not speak to him. Abrego Garcia's partner, Jennifer, said she was, quote, shocked when the government said he should stay detained because Kilmar is an MS-13 gang member. Kilmar is not and has never been a gang member. I'm certain of that. In June of 2019, while Abrego Garcia was still detained, he and Jennifer got married, exchanging rings from an officer separated by a pane of glass. Later that year, a judge ruled that Abrego Garcia could not be deported back to El Salvador because he might be murdered by Barrio 18, that his fear was credible. Abrego Garcia was then set free. Each year since then, he has checked in with immigration authorities. He's been employed as a sheet metal apprentice. He's a member of the local union. He was studying for a vocational license at University of Maryland. His last check-in with immigration authorities was on January 2nd. No incident. There is no evidence anywhere offered by anyone that has suggested Abrego Garcia poses a threat to anyone in this country. But on March 12th, Abrego Garcia was pulled over while driving, his 5-year-old in the backseat. He was told his immigration status had changed. On March 15th, in defiance of the 2019 court ruling, Abrego Garcia was flown to El Salvador and imprisoned at CICAT as a terrorist. The Trump administration, in its own legal filings, has said this was a, quote, administrative error. They themselves, their administration, said they should not have done this. It was a mistake. That they should not have done this is not just my opinion. I want to read to you from the editorial of the National Review, probably the country's leading conservative magazine. Here is the first sentence. The court fight over Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia is a most unusual one in that no one denies that the government violated the law in deporting him. This case has made its way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ordered that the administration, quote, facilitate Abrego Garcia's release from custody in El Salvador and ensure that his case is handled as it would have been had he not been improperly sent to El Salvador.
I don't actually think that our government doesn't know this. Okay? I want to be clear about that. I think they know all of these details. They admitted in a court filing, the person who, the lawyer for the DOJ who admitted it was an administrative error has been put on leave of absence. He didn't lie, though. He told the truth. And that has not been disputed anywhere. Anything?
Yeah, it's just, I think one of the things that strikes me, and I'm sure strikes everyone here, is the dehumanization that's happening, right? People not treated as people. And that's what makes it so hard to watch, those photographs and hear those stories. I think one thing I'm just going to offer here is we kind of pivot and turn a corner towards, like, what do we do in response to what is happening? One of the temptations, I think, for me, I'll just say, and maybe not for you, is to also dehumanize the other side, right? And I think if we give in to that temptation as we try and resist what is happening, I don't think we actually will get to where we hope to go. And so I just say that here kind of for myself and maybe for others in the room, that we have to keep checking ourselves. And that's why Valerie's stuff about love, while perhaps sounding naive, is actually the thing that we cannot lose in all of this.
Okay, fun little break. Just quick, catch our breath, you know.
I live in Brooklyn now. Whenever I tell my friends my family's Republican, they're always like, you need to confront them. You need to talk to them. You need to convince them they're wrong. And I'm like, yeah, man, they don't respect me. They think I'm a pussy because I eat hummus. They're like, Jeffrey likes that Sharia peanut butter. All my friends are like, you need to convince them to support universal health care. I'm like, we need to start smaller than that. How about I convince them roundabouts aren't communist? My uncle's like, roundabouts are just the liberals trying to trick us into going right for a bit, then left forever. That joke's funny if you know what a circle is.
We're going to turn to some mix of action, contemplation, and resilience. It's all in the ones we've selected here. We can't do all 20. But this is from Timothy Snyder's book. It is how many lessons? It is 20. 20 lessons from the 20th century, 2017. Timothy Snyder is still a Yale professor. He has taken a position at the University of Toronto, however, because of the political situation and because of his fear of the Trump administration. Just to tell you how one person who studies this is feeling and acting. But Jonathan Lithgow did a dramatic reading of these, and they are legitimately helpful. So we're going to go through some of them.
Hi, I'm John Lithgow. I'm going to read you 20 Lessons on Tyranny by Timothy Snyder. You may have already heard these, but it's time you heard them again. Number one, do not obey in advance. Most of the power of authoritarianism is freely given. In times like these, individuals think ahead about what a more repressive government will want and then offer themselves without being asked. A citizen who adapts in this way is teaching power what it can do. Number two, defend institutions. It is institutions that help us to preserve decency. They need our help as well. Do not speak of our institutions unless you make them yours by acting on their behalf. Institutions do not protect themselves. They fall one after the other unless each is defended from the beginning. So choose an institution you care about, a court, a newspaper, a law, a labor union, and take its side.
So I'm sorry to say we have already seen a lot of obeying in advance. As you probably know, if you watched the inauguration, you saw all the tech leaders there obeying in advance, obviously so. Law firms have been pressured, and unfortunately many of them have caved to that pressure. It turns out, I found this today, it's just some random dude quite literally doing these deals with law firms. His name is Epstein. He doesn't work for the government. It's not even clear that he has any law practice. These are just extortions. University of Michigan, unfortunately, shuttered its DEI program, obeying in advance. Ohio State, University of Iowa, similar. I could go on. There are many more. I am happy to report this one somewhat new development, which is that Harvard has chosen to fight back. And this is a big deal. I think it's, like, important. If we win the fight against this fascist administration, this will be one of the key moments, I think. What was being asked of them is completely ridiculous. And they were right to say no to it. The university will not surrender its independence or relinquish its constitutional rights. That's from the president. Steve Levitsky, a Harvard political science who had been urging the university to take a tougher stand against Mr. Trump, read Dr. Garber's letter before a class about authoritarianism and democracy. It looks like Harvard has decided it's time to fight, he said when he began. The room of about 100 students, he said, erupted in applause. So there is some good news that I want to report.
Yeah. So that's the do not obey in advance. And the other one he talks about is defending institutions. And one thing that I've been hearing, you know, we've been reading from really a wide range of people, there's a phrase that keeps coming up as you think about supporting institutions and just doing this work in general that's going to be required of us. The phrase is pick your lane. Lithgow says, he reads, support an institution. I think that's helpful to note. In other words, you and I cannot support every institution, right? We cannot take action against every aspect of this authoritarianism regime. You and I have to figure out what lane we're going to be in, what matters a lot to us, or what gifts or resources we have to resist a certain aspect of what is going on. And then we've got to stay in that lane mostly. Maybe occasionally we step out. But if we're trying to do it all or respond to it all or be in multiple lanes at once, it's going to be too much, right? So I appreciated that little A-N in there and that idea of picking a lane. Yeah.
And one thing, I don't have time to play this really great clip about how international law and human rights, mainly it's human rights, coming into practice after World War II, but I realized, this is from Autocracy, Inc. by Ann Applebaum, but I realized in hindsight that because of our work in Israel-Palestine, my parents before me, human rights and international law has become really important to me. Like, I see the value in it. And in some ways, I'm amazed that after World War II, we put these things in practice. They really are quite an incredible achievement. If you read these things about human rights, if you read how it happened, the people who were involved, Eleanor Roosevelt was the one who started the commission. There was an Indian woman who was a part of the commission. I can't remember her name now, but Mehta, something like, I'm sorry that I can't remember, I wish I could. Somebody from China promoting Confucianism. This was really a worldwide affair, and it was an amazing accomplishment, and we are in the process of just letting it unravel and die, and we shouldn't do that. So that's the one place where I'm digging in. Oh, I want to do this one. All right, here's a few more lessons.
Number 4, take responsibility for the face of the world. The symbols of today enable the reality of tomorrow. Notice the swastikas and the other signs of hate. Do not look away and do not get used to them. Remove them yourself and set an example for others to do so. Number 8, stand out. Someone has to. It is easy to follow along. It can feel strange to do or say something different. But without that unease, there is no freedom. Remember Rosa Parks. The moment you set an example, the spell of the status quo is broken, and others will follow. Number 9, be kind to our language. Avoid pronouncing the phrases everyone else does. Think up your own way of speaking, even if only to convey that thing that you think everyone is saying. Make an effort to separate yourself from the internet. Read books.
There's so much I love about this one. Let me give an example today of something that I did very intentionally. I don't like to use myself as an example, but I'm going to use it this time. See what you think of it. And I've done this before. So I went to my daughter's her first tennis match. She is at Zeeland Public Schools. That tells you a lot already, right, who I'm encountering when I go there. And I saw a couple of friends who are similar-minded to me next to some people that I, or surrounded by people I didn't know, but I had a pretty good idea of where they were. And they said, my friend said, his name is Bob, he said, how are you doing? And I said, I'm terrible. I'm terrible. And he goes, oh, no. And I said, well, my personal life, and I said it as loud as I could. My personal life is good, but I'm struggling a little bit with the end of democracy, if I'm being honest. And it was just a little way, because I knew everybody else around that had to hear me say it. And then they had to think about the fact that somebody like that exists in their community. And maybe that's something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. You should use yourself as an example more.
Okay.
Yeah, that was good.
Deal.
One thing I want to say that stuck out to me here is this very last line of, you know, read more books. Separate yourself from the internet, read more books. I like that. I want us to also think about just separating ourselves from the madness entirely. That there is a lot of work to do, but if we do not step away in ways that reground us, we're never going to make it. We are not even 100 days in. We have years at the minimum. We've got to be taking care of ourselves. And I don't, the thing is that I can't offer to you what that thing is. You've got to sort that out for yourself, right? And I've got to sort it out for myself. We've got to figure out what helps reground us. So today for me, I'll use myself as an example here. I got into our backyard for about 15 minutes with a set of binoculars, and I just watched our bird feeder. That was it.
Bird watching does come at you hard in middle age, doesn't it?
It does, it does. Yeah. It's surprising. There I was, you know. For me, in this moment in my life, that is a very regrounding activity. And it helps just kind of reset things, right? For you, it's going to be something different. But we've got to find those things and practice them regularly.
So one last thing. So he said at the beginning, it's right, take care of the face of the world or something like that, care about the face of the world. And he said swastikas and other forms of hate. I'm going to say this out loud, but for me, MAGA symbols are signs of hate and division. They're like Confederate flags to me. They're no different at this point. Am I going to go around taking them down or taking them off people's heads? I'm not going to do that, right? Can I imagine a future in which those are banned in the United States because they're so shameful to us and what happened under that regime? I can absolutely imagine it. I think that's, in a way, the only good future we have, if that is totally rejected and those are seen similar to swastikas. I might be wrong on that. That might be too big of a bold of a statement. But that's where I'm at right now. That's how I feel. When I see them, I want to tear them off. I do. I spent all of 2020 giving a middle finger to every MAGA thing I saw. I'm serious. I did it in my car. I didn't do it in person. Every time I passed a flag, I gave the middle finger. I made sure my daughter saw me doing it because I wanted them to know that, fuck this. This is wrong. This is hateful. And I will not stand for it. I don't know what happens there, but I just want to say the thing that we're all thinking when he said swastikas and other forms of hate, you know? Okay. Let's go to somebody gentler, right?
Yeah.
We need it.
Yeah, we do.
This is Valerie Kaur again, and let's continue on the revolutionary love compass. Sorry.
We turn the compass once more to ourselves. How do we love ourselves? This is the wisdom of the midwife. She says, breathe and push. How are you breathing every day? Are you breathing with music, with meditation, with poetry? Are you breathing with the earth, with the sea, with the stars? And what is your particular push in your life? Is it the push of healing or forgiveness or apology or reconciliation? We must be able to transition ourselves as we are transitioning the world around us. The midwife holds wisdom for how to sustain our energy in any long labor. We must breathe and then push and then breathe again. And when we do that, we let in enough space in our lives to let joy in. Joy is the gift of love. Joy gives us energy for that long labor. How are you protecting joy every single day? I invite you to take this compass into all arenas of your life, and at any given moment, in any given season, you can decide what it is you need in that moment to love others, to love opponents, and to love ourselves.
Sorry, I kind of went out of order there. You can see that's the end. We'll get back to the other video. My dog does not know that Trump is president. And he is happy as a lark all the time. And that is helpful to me. I will admit, yep. We go out, I throw the ball. I know he also has a dog that is probably more, like, the most obsessed with fetch that I know of in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. It's helping me. My dog helps me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not afraid to admit that.
Yeah, I've been trying to learn from people who have been at the work of resisting and fighting injustice. You know, people have been at this work for a long time. I'm kind of catching up, right? And someone I follow, a black woman, psychologist, activist.
No surprise, right?
Talks about joy as a form of resistance. That, for me, was a shift. Some of you are nodding. You've already thought about this, perhaps. But it is a practice of resistance. Dr. Shaniqua Walker-Bounds, another activist and theologian and psychologist, actually, says we fight better when we have joy to live for. So don't feel badly about feeling joy. In fact, seek it out. We've got to find it and live into it and lean into it as much as we can.
Yeah, it's not a betrayal to people who are suffering for you to feel some joy in your life. Sometimes it feels that way, you know, if you're really tuned into the world and what's happening. But it's not a betrayal. It's okay. It's necessary. More lessons.
Number 12, make eye contact and small talk. This is not just polite. It is part of being a citizen and a responsible member of society. It is also a way to stay in touch with your surroundings, break down social barriers, and understand whom you should and should not trust. If we enter a culture of denunciation, you will want to know the psychological landscape of your daily life. Number 13, practice corporeal politics. Power wants your body softening in your chair and your emotions dissipating on the screen. Get outside. Put your body in unfamiliar places with unfamiliar people. Make new friends and march with them. Number 15, contribute to good causes. Be active in organizations, political or not, that express your own view of life. Pick a charity or two and set up auto pay. Then you will have made a free choice that supports civil society and helps others to do good. Number 16, learn from peers in other countries. Keep up your friendships abroad or make new friends in other countries. The present difficulties in the United States are an element of a larger trend. And no country is going to find a solution by itself. Make sure you and your family have passports.
There's some tough practical stuff in there, man. But it's true, and it's right, and we need to take this advice. Still processing, will happily accept your donation. If I didn't say that, my dad would kill me, and rightfully so. So I'm going to say that right at the beginning. I love the make eye contact and small talk. I love that one. It's my favorite of these, if I'm being honest. A long time ago, when Dr. Myers was here from Hope College, we talked about micro-friendships, which is what this is describing. It means don't give up on your fellow human in a way. And by not giving up on them, you might actually be making a difference in their life in some way. And you're enriching your own life. One other really quick example of this from my life. I go to Meijer a lot because I don't plan anything, so I go almost every day. It's not good. It's not going to change. Whatever. And so, you know, they have greeters. And so I'm seeing, and when I check out, I'm seeing the same people. And I just was like, what if I knew their names? Would that be good? Yeah. So then I became friendly with a guy named Rodrigo. And we just said hi to each other. We said each other's names as we came in. Then Trump won, and he asked me how I was doing, and I said, terrible, and he was happy. And I was so disappointed. I was so disappointed. But I was still seeing him every day. I took a little time off from saying hi, I'll be honest. I'm not... I'm not perfect, okay? I'm sorry. But I'm back to saying hi to him. I'm back saying his name. And I don't know. It's a thing I keep doing, I guess.
Yeah, that making new friends is really powerful.
It is.
Rodrigo, maybe one level of friendship, right, if we could. You know, I wonder, too, about the simple acts of, like, having people into our homes. For me, COVID ruined that. It completely changed my social behavior. Maybe not for you. But I've really been thinking about that. Like, who I need to be with people, because the draw is to just be on my phone, holed up in a corner, scrolling away, trying to work the algorithm to only get dogs on my screen. You know, I just want dogs. That's all I'm looking for. That's the pull is towards isolation. And so I've been trying to think about, what does it mean for me to just be with people of solidarity? Do I need to also think about people who I disagree with? Yes, but that's different. I need to be with people who can help me stay on my feet, to be honest. And so maybe it's as simple as letting people come into my messy house and being okay with my house being messy. And just saying, let's make spaghetti together. I don't got anything more than that to offer. But would you love to come over? And I bet they're probably going to say yes. And you would say yes to people too. There are other ways to be engaged, I think, that are beyond that. But I wonder, for me at least, if it doesn't just start with some simple practices like that.
And one last thing is, so Anne Applebaum is a really good author. I've recommended her before. I recommend her again. Her husband is Polish. She has Polish citizenship. She knows these places where these things have happened. Hungary being sort of a prime example. Turkey. India. Okay? These people already know what's going to happen next to us. And I think the other thing to note, and I said this already, but I'll reiterate it, this is a network. Autocracies are a network that help each other. So we're not, even if we thought somehow what was happening here is unique, we've already seen that Trump and his administration, they're going to use these other autocratic regimes. I saw Witkoff, who's, what even is he? It hurts my brain that this man is out there doing foreign policy, but he's just some real estate guy that Donald Trump knows, and he's spent time with Putin, and he's talking about all these economic opportunities that we have with Russia. That is enmeshing us in that network of autocratic regimes. It's bad if that happens. To say nothing of Ukraine, of course, right? Okay, we got more to get to. Should we do something fun? Okay.
And now, okay, from my house, where I have to intro a different video than the one I used because it didn't translate well enough to audio only. This is just a little comedy bit from a gentleman talking about how he actually has learned a lot under the second Trump administration.
The one nice thing I'll say about Trump is I feel like I really understand what tariffs are now. I kind of knew before, but now I'm like, oh wow, that's really a big part of the economy. In a way, that's I think Trump is kind of presented like a Schoolhouse Rock level of why the government's so fucked up. Every time he gets rid of something, I look it up. I'm like, oh, what is that thing? Oh no! That's super important. He may have gotten rid of the Department of Education, but he's taught me more than any president before.
All right, these are our last bit of advice from Timothy Snyder, read by John Lithgow, and then a couple other things. We'll open it up for questions.
17. Listen for dangerous words. Be alert to the use of the words extremism and terrorism. Be alive to the fatal notions of emergency and exception. Be angry about the treacherous use of patriotic vocabulary. Number 18, be calm when the unthinkable arrives. Modern tyranny is terror management. When the terrorist attack comes, remember that authoritarians exploit such events in order to consolidate power. The sudden disaster that requires the end of checks and balances, the dissolution of opposition parties, the suspension of freedom of expression, the right to a fair trial, and so on, is the oldest trick in the Hitlerian book. Do not fall for it. Number 19, be a patriot. Set a good example of what America means for the generations to come. They will need it. Number 20, be as courageous as you can. If none of us is prepared to die for freedom, then all of us will die under tyranny.
Do not obey in advance. Defend institutions. Take responsibility for the face of the world. Stand out. Be kind to our language. Make eye contact and small talk. Practice corporeal politics. Contribute to good causes. Learn from peers in other countries. Listen for dangerous words. Be calm when the unthinkable arrives. Be a patriot. Be as courageous as you can.
So, in that meeting in the Oval Office, all those dangerous words were used, and they were all lies. Bukele called Kilmer Abego-Garcia a terrorist. That is an absurdly false label, right? I've even stopped using the word myself because of Valerie Kaur's wisdom of enemy and use the word opponent instead. It just doesn't, it hits less hard. It allows the possibility that that person could stop being an opponent. Enemy just feels very permanent to me. And then one last thing is that one of the hardest ones in there is be a patriot. Because I've never been a terribly patriotic person, to be honest. But I think this is actually really going to be quite essential. And what I mean is that we define what America is to be for ourselves. We need a vision based on what it has been. Some of the best of us, right? The civil rights movement, obviously, being an example of the best of us. And I say that so that they, meaning our opponents, are not the only ones that have a patriotic vision, that we also have one, and it's different from theirs, and it's hopefully, I think, and rightfully, inspiring. Something inspiring that other people can come around about a vision for the United States. I do think that's important, even though that is not a natural instinct of mine. This is the last piece from Valerie Kaur.
Now, what if an opponent is standing in front of you? I invite you to turn that compass so the word opponent is at the top. That practice is called tend the wound. There are no such thing as monsters in this world, only human beings who are wounded, who act out of their insecurity or greed or fear. That doesn't make them any less dangerous. But when we see their wound, they lose their power over us. We become smarter about how we respond. Notice I don't use the word enemy. An enemy is a fixed and permanent identity. An opponent is anyone whose ideas or beliefs or actions oppose yours. It begins with tending your own wound. It begins with rage. The solution is not to suppress your rage or to let your rage explode, but to process your rage in safe containers. And once you do, you can ask yourself, what information does my rage carry? What does it say about what's important to me? You can choose to harness that energy for what you do in the world. I call that harnessed energy divine rage. The aim of divine rage is not vengeance. It is to reorder the world. If you are safe enough or brave enough, you can move on to that next practice, which is to listen to our opponents. Deep listening is an act of surrender. You risk being changed by what you hear. When you listen to your opponent, the goal is to understand them. And when you understand them, you gain information for that next practice, which is to reimagine. Reimagine an outcome that leaves no one behind, not even them. Raging, listening, reimagining, these are the core practices for how to show up with love, even for your opponents.
So, you know, this is focused on the opponent, but notice where it begins. With you, right? So we're back to that idea that part of the work here, perhaps the most important, or at least the beginning part of the work for us, is to pay attention to what's happening to ourselves, to make sure that we are giving ourselves space to feel, to acknowledge, to express in safe places with safe people what we are feeling, be it rage, be it anger, be it fear, be it whatever it might be. That work, only when we have done it, are we able then to move openly towards another person and listen to them. And so I'm just coming back to what we already talked about. We have to really take seriously what we are doing to create quiet spaces, contemplative spaces, if we want to use that word, to be still enough to pay attention to where we're at and to give ourselves space to feel. Yeah.
And I'll just name a struggle that I have right now, which is I just want to do rage towards them. That's where I'm at. I'll be honest. I don't want to listen anymore. I'll reimagine. I am so tired of listening to this. I am so tired. I feel like I've spent 10 years trying to understand only for it to be complete absurdity and cruelty. So I consider this a safe place. So this is my contained rage, is this. I don't want to listen anymore. I don't care what you think. I don't care what your arguments are for supporting this. This is wrong. It is hurting the lives of real people. Next week, my wife has a naturalization appointment to be naturalized as a U.S. citizen, and we are terrified that they are going to find out that I am an advocate for Palestinians, and they're going to take it out on her. I talked to a lawyer because I was so afraid of that. Maybe that's naive. Maybe I shouldn't be. It doesn't matter. This is the climate that now exists, where people like me, never broken any law. I mean, I've broken a lot of laws, never been caught. Okay, let's be clear. Let's be clear. She is the most upstanding. She's a social worker at a high school, for God's sake, right? So I'm not at listen anymore. Not currently at listen, and I just wanted to say that out loud.
My battery's almost dead.
Switch. Turn that one on, though. Right here. Boom.
But.
Yeah.
You have to say what you just said, here and elsewhere. giving voice to these emotions are so, it's just essential. We have to do it. And it's scary, maybe. We might be surprised by how strong the emotions are in us, right? Which is why we need a safe place or trusted and safe people. But it's just critical. We have to do it.
Yeah. I see you, Annie. Can I do a couple more things and come back to you? Okay. I want to show you this as a little bit of energy, a little bit of fight. It's already happening out there, okay? And then I have one last thing, and then we'll do questions. That is Senator Chuck Grassley. He is 1,000 years old. I rounded up. I'm sorry.
Oh, boy.
Okay. To his credit, he was brave enough to have an actual town hall in Iowa. I'm sure he thought it was going to go okay. This is how it actually went.
Are you going to bring that guy back from El Salvador?
Yeah.
Are you?
Yeah.
Why not?
Well, because that's not a power of Congress.
The Supreme Court said to bring him back.
The judges are. Yeah, the president is.
Excuse me, Senator. Senator, excuse me, on that same subject.
Hey!
Excuse me. Senator Grassley, on that same subject, the Constitution, the framers of the Constitution, said that every person, right, not citizen, right, every person within the jurisdiction of the United States has due process. We would like to know what you, as the people, the Congress, who are supposed to rein in this dictator, what are you going to do about it? These people have been sentenced to life imprisonment in a foreign country with no due process. Our government cannot do anything. Why won't you do your job, Senator?
Yeah. Yes. Why?
A constitutional crisis exists when you have a president who ignores the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
You have a Congress who fails to rein in a third branch of our government.
That's right.
Who is now violating our Constitution. You took an oath. I do solemnly swear or affirm. Do you remember that, sir? Yes, sir. That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same. That I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion. And that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of office of which I am about to enter. So help me God. Sir, will you act upon your oath?
Yeah, I thought that I was when I answered.
So, I mean, I love all those people in there. They're making me so happy when I saw it. And I almost didn't include the last one because it's not as fiery, right? I wanted to end on the one guy who yells. What does he yell at the beginning? Oh, the guy from El Salvador. I love that guy. And then, right before the last guy starts that I showed, he goes, get a spine! Exactly. I mean, exactly. But I wanted to include the last guy because you can show your displeasure in a lot of different ways. And this guy did it in a really different way, the last guy. He said, let me read to you. And it's so good, man. Let me read to you your oath of office. Are you going to fulfill? I love it. Right? So whatever your style is, do it. That form of resistance, do it. I have one more. Can I just stretch it one more? It's 4 minutes and then I'll be done, I promise. Last time I mentioned Rutger Bregman last month, very briefly. This is a part of the story that I am going to tell about humanity, the story that he tells in his book, which is a different story than I think the Trump administration, I think largely Christianity as well. This is not the story they tell about humankind, but it's the story that I'm going to tell. And I think it's important that we have different stories to tell.
My name's Rutger Bregman, and I'm the author of the new book, Humankind, A Hopeful History.
It's a book about a simple but quite radical idea. What if most people, deep down, are pretty decent? In the past 15 to 20 years, there has been a silent revolution in science. Scientists from very diverse disciplines, psychologists, anthropologists, archaeologists, sociologists, have moved from a quite cynical view of human nature to a much more positive and hopeful view, and have actually been arguing that we are hardwired to be friendly and to cooperate, and that actually this is our true superpower as a species. Now, I think this is a quite revolutionary idea, because what you assume in other people is what you get out of them. If you assume that most people deep down are just selfish, as we have been assuming for the past 30 to 40 years, then you'll start designing your institutions around that idea, right? Your schools, your workplaces, your democracies, and that's what you get out of people. What you assume in other people is what you get out of them. Now, if we move to a new, more hopeful, more realistic view of human nature, I think that changes everything. And it's also a quite subversive idea, because if we don't trust each other, if we think that, you know, people are deep down are just selfish, then we need them, you know, then we need the CEOs and the presidents and the bureaucrats and the generals and the monarchs and the kings and you name it. We need those in power to keep each other in check. But if we actually believe in each other, if we believe that most people can be trusted, then we can move to a very different kind of society, a much more egalitarian kind of society where, yeah, we bring out the best in each other. That's the simple but quite radical idea that I'm defending in my book, Humankind, A Hopeful History. So at one point I was interviewing a psychologist who had been doing fascinating work on the so-called bystander theory, which is the idea that during times of crises or when there's an emergency, say someone's drowning or, you know, someone's attacked in the street, that we don't help. And this psychologist actually showed that in 90% of all cases, based on CCTV camera footage, right, so real incidents, in 90% of all cases, people actually help each other. And so I told her about new theories from biology, where biologists lately have been talking about the concept of survival of the friendliest, which has been happening in our evolution. You know, that for thousands of years, it was actually the friendliest among us who had the most kids and so had the biggest chance of passing on their genes to the next generation. And I told her about this, and she said, oh my God, so it's been happening there as well. And this is the only thing that I've been trying to do, is just to connect the dots, to show that there's something bigger going on, that the zeitgeist is changing and that we're moving into a new era right now, the pandemic. We need a more hopeful view of human history. We need a more hopeful view of who we really are ourselves. Because now we are not going to be able to survive with the values of the past 30 to 40 years. We're not going to survive with more emphasis on competition and selfishness. Right now, we need friendliness, cooperation, and we need hope. And I hope that my book will give you a little bit of that. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's one of the articles of faith that I'm holding on to right now, that we actually can do that, that we actually are good deep down, that we do want to see each other thrive. Questions? Annie, should I come to you? Okay.
Mine was just more of a comment on that last phase of that chart with the lady that spoke. I don't know names. Yep. But I appreciated when Chris said safe people, because as a survivor of domestic abuse, safe people is key. But I also struggle greatly with a lot of people in this world right now, especially in our country. And I would not classify them as safe people. So then to say that there aren't monsters, as she said, it's a really hard one.
Yeah, appreciate that honesty. Yep.
Again, I think when she says there are not monsters in this world, only wounded people, I think that's, at this point, an article of faith, not an article of science, right? It's something that she's holding on to as true.
You might appreciate her. She has a history of abuse in her life, and she speaks from that often. So if you're curious about her, if you found her interesting at all, you'll learn more about that if you spend more time with her. So,
a couple quick comments about growing a spine. I saw Lisa Murkowski on today, and she actually said out loud, "We're afraid of Donald Trump." Lisa Murkowski is a senator from Alaska.
Yep.
And a Republican, yeah. So anyway, when we leave our little cul-de-sac that we live on, every time we leave, we pass this house prior to the election that had a flag that said, "Latinos for Trump."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned this to a friend of mine who provides medical care at a free clinic, and they have a lot of Hispanic people at that clinic, and a lot of them are undocumented. So we're having this conversation, and I said, "Why are they voting for Trump?" He said, "Because they want to keep undocumented people out of the United States." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because they're afraid they'll work for even less money than what we are already, and they'll take our jobs."
Mm.
Now, that flag is still up there, and I find myself wondering if they are leaving that flag up there because they think it will protect them. Like, "We voted for you." So the last comment I would say was to Josh was, I did see something the other day on the news that there are groups of universities, a Big Ten university, talking about banding together to provide legal aid in case any of them is attacked going forward.
Good.
So,
thank you. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things, we had some other, I said this already, I had a bazillion other clips, but one of them was about this zero-sum thinking, and it reminded me of what you said there, right? Zero-sum thinking is like, if somebody else gets something, then it has to be taken away from somebody else. That's the only way it works. And that is a huge, huge mistake. That way of thinking about our country, it's a scarcity mindset as opposed to an abundance mindset. It's crazy that our country has a somewhat a scarcity mindset. I think the other thing at play is like, we have a hierarchical society. We just do. This is a part of how we have evolved because of racism, I think, mostly. And for a lot of people, it's okay to be below some other people as long as you're above the right people. This is a huge, huge societal problem that we have.
Yeah.
Anybody else? I'm coming. You're going to come? No, I'm on it.
That's right. So something I found to be helpful from the 20 lessons was the pick a lane idea. I think two areas that I struggle in when it comes to going from intention to action are feeling like I don't have complete understanding of a situation and therefore cannot speak on it. And I don't have a hard time identifying things I care about, but I do sometimes have a hard time seeing myself as someone who has something to offer in those situations, not having a legal background or not having a fill-in-the-blank background. I imagine those are challenges that other people are experiencing as well, and things that are holding others back from acting, and I'm wondering if anyone has found a way to deal with that effectively.
Yeah, I don't have a solution for you per se, but I'll say a couple of things. I don't know what I'm doing. Activists that I follow say that one of the first steps when they spot injustice is education.
And so you're speaking to something here that I think a lot of people do feel, and this person has named. So she says, step one quite often is to educate yourself. And you don't have to be an expert. So I think we underestimate our presence. Showing up, I think we underestimate. But if you think about it, what if you were the only one here tonight? You would probably feel differently than you do looking around the room and seeing that there are a bunch of other people here who are trying to figure this out as well. And did anyone else here offer expertise? No, they just showed up. So showing up matters and shouldn't be, minimized or diminished. And I think when we show up, what we discover is that, maybe we did offer something by being there, but we also are changed by the presence of other people, right? So I'm just offering an encouragement to show up, even if you don't feel like you have what you think you need in that moment. Yeah.
Let's see if this is working. It is. I also think some of our identities mean we can be on the front lines of things and we're at much less risk than other people. And that's going to be important. That's just... Okay. Anybody else? Otherwise, okay. Last one.
This isn't profound or anything, but you remember when Brian McLaren said to say, I see that differently. Yeah. I just keep that in my back pocket because I don't have to know a lot to say I see it differently, and I might say how I feel it, but then I can say I don't have to have all the facts is kind of what I'm trying to say. You know, just I see that differently. It just makes them think, oh, you see that, you know, anyway.
Trust yourself. I think a lot of us have been programmed to not trust ourselves, not trust our emotions, not trust our intuition for various reasons. Sometimes religious, obviously, has done that to a lot of us. Trust yourself. Right? What Bregman is saying is that we have a long history of caring about each other, and that's part of the reason we made it this far. So I just encourage you to trust yourself. And that's a great place to end. Thank you so much for being here. Hope to see you next month.